Running a business keeps you on your toes. Wouldn't it be great if your internet connection could keep up? Introducing Business Class Fiber from Vox. It's super fast, reliable, and highly cost-effective. You get unlimited calls to all SA destinations, and it's scalable. So no matter the size of your business, you've still got room to grow. Get connected with Business Class Fiber from Vox and see what super fast internet really means. For more information, visit vox.co.za.
Thank you for downloading the Tech Central podcast. My name is Duncan MacLeod. I'm super excited about the interview we have lined up next. It's with none other than Vumatel CEO Neil Schoeman. Neil, welcome to Tech Central.
No, thanks for having me.
So this is one podcast that I wish we were doing live because I'm sure there are tons of people who have plenty of questions they'd want to ask you about the fiber to the home market in South Africa. I suppose the question everyone wants to know is when the fiber is coming to them. But hopefully we'll get to answer a lot of the questions that people have during the course of our discussion today. So thanks for joining us. Before we get into the big discussion about the FTTH market in South Africa and about Vumatel and where the company is at, I just want to find out a bit more about you, Neil. I think a lot of people don't know your particular history, your background. If you don't mind, maybe just give us a bit of an overview of your career history, where you come from.
Okay. Well, I'm a Burki from the Free State, studied at Stellenbosch Industrial Engineering, and then got into the SAP Oracle, the ERP game here in the late 90s, when if anybody could spell SAP, they were a god, and went overseas to the UK for about 11 years, where I deployed large projects for places like the UN and so on, and where we learned and developed sort of big complex technology deployment skills. And in 2003, decided to embark on my own and started the Birchman Group. And here by 2007, we were in 10 countries, sort of a big consulting firm, and came back to SA to sort of semi-retire. My first daughter was born, there's sort of salmon coming home to where you were born. And sort of 12 months in, the handicap was lower, but we were a little bit bored. And DFA was actually just started at that stage with a deployment to the tower networks. Mm. And they were looking for a party that can help them to manage this sort of complex deployment program. And they engaged my firm, the Birchman Group, and we effectively built, I don't know, the first 2.5 years worth of DFA's network for them as a partner. And while we were doing that, obviously we got a lot of skills and understanding of the fiber market and could see what was going to happen in South Africa, or we believed we could see. And we decided that the next wave would be fiber to the business. And we started Conduct Telecommunications, me and Johan Pretorius. And we fibered up the business precincts, the classic one, Sandton, Techno Park, down in the Cape, you know, all of the business precincts. And then 2 years later, 2.5 years later, DFA realized that that would really help to extend their network and came back and purchased us at the time. And then the next wave came on. I mean, obviously the natural evolution next was fiber to the home, and Telkom was not really doing anything about it at the time.
In fact, at the time, I remember asking the CEOs of the big telcos, why aren't you doing fiber to the home? And the common answer from all of them was, it doesn't make financial sense.
Yeah, I think we learned obviously by deploying thousands of kilometers of fiber at the time, we built up a lot of experience, and in the more entrepreneurial way, rather than the big corporate way. Mm. And I think Telkom at the time, it was not really incentivized to invest capital when you have 100% market share. Mm. So we had a business case actually for about a year in a drawer somewhere, which started over a whiskey in Katsi's actually in Illovo. And then Parkhurst came online, and the consumer was so frustrated with the lack of connectivity.
Yeah.
And they sort of went out and put their hands up and say, look, can somebody come and help us? And there was actually quite a lot of interest at that particular point in time. I remember chatting to you at that point
yes.
in time. And we decided that the open access model really works, separating infrastructure from services, and that makes it efficient enough that the metropolitan areas can be built. And to try and take a consumer-orientated approach rather than, you know, some of these classic larger fiber to the business type of guys that wants to make sure that they've got a call off contract before they start. We took a model view rather than, let's say, a pre-order view. And obviously from there on in, we started off and built Parkhurst, and that's 2.5 years later now, just under 2.5 years later.
So was Parkhurst a proof of concept for you in a way?
Yeah.
Wanted to prove the business case in one suburb, and if it worked, then take it further.
Yeah. Okay. We always knew that the economics would sort of work in a way if everything stood up. In fact, we had Parkhurst to Ponty was our initial plan.
Right.
Sort of a swathe from Parkhurst to Ponty Towers. We thought it'd be cool to give a gig in Ponty Towers while Houghton's just across the road. And to look at the different demographics along the way. That was the original case before Parkhurst coincidentally came online.
Yeah.
And we always had own money, pilot, make sure that the levers in the business case works, and then injected more cash to see if we could replicate it into a couple of further suburbs to see if the model still holds, and then basically went out for external funding to, okay, now let's throw some nitrogen into the engine and industrialize the processes.
So who were the guys behind Vumatel? Who started? Yourself? Who
and Johan Pretorius.
And Johan Pretorius.
Yeah.
Okay. Is
he
still involved?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's a COO.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
And so you did Parkhurst. You rolled out Parkhurst. Was there anything unexpected that came out of that that deployment?
Not really. We were surprised. The Parkhurst community was really very active. I mean, I was surprised about how active it was, and I think they're unique in a certain degree. They are really a sort of an activist type residence association. We were surprised about the interest that it sparked in the media. We thought it'll be a pilot and eventually people will get it, but it really grabbed the attention of the marketplace. And the fact that Telkom reacted right there and then was also of interest. We thought that they would let this run a while before reacting to the competitive pressures.
And they didn't.
And they tried to, and they then activated their fiber to the home program, but it obviously is a bigger animal. It takes a while to get that off the ground. But they did. They did react.
Okay. Is it a race now between you and Telkom?
I don't know. I think probably. I would guess so. There's some smaller players in the marketplace.
Yeah.
But I would guess that from a subscriber base, we're probably very similar at the moment. Homes passed, they're probably further ahead, but our definitions are not necessarily exactly the same. But yeah, I would guess it is a race. Our focus is the metropolitan area, so I think it makes immediate sense. And then over time, the secondary cities will make sense. Whether we'll get to Kukunap one day, I don't know, but we think that there's a good 500,000 to a million homes available that could be serviced over the next 3-4 years still.
Is that base the same as the existing DSL base, or is it a new base?
I think it's very similar to the DSL base.
So this is a replacement business.
It's a replacement at the moment. There's some views in the marketplace to say that wherever there's a DSTV subscription, that could also potentially be a fiber to the home connection, but I think the backhaul cost and so on to get to some of these more remote sites makes it a little bit tricky still. But the economies of scale are coming down, and who knows? So you might be able to get there at some stage. But definitely the metropolitan areas, the secondary cities, and the large towns are all in play.
Okay. So you mentioned that you self-funded it initially, but then went to a first round of funding. You've done a number of funding rounds now. You've done them with banks. Investec, I seem to recall, is one of them.
Yeah, Investec Equity Partners, so their equity arm, is an equity partner with us. The management still owns a majority collectively. And then Standard Bank and Vantage Capital provides our senior and mezzanine funding.
Okay.
Yeah. So we still try and keep it simple.
Okay. Do you guys still have a decent stake in the business after all these funding rounds?
Yes. I suppose if we still have a majority, then yes. But okay. It is eye-watering capital that we do deploy.
I'm sure. Not cheap, this business.
No, it's not cheap, this business. But it is. It's a very defensible asset, we think, in the long term. We firmly believe it, and our business partners do as well. Mm. We're very grateful for that.
Okay. So just stepping back, I want to talk a bit more about where Vumatel is now, but let's just go back to the history a little bit more. Yeah. In those early days when you were sitting in Catsey's drawing up the idea and when you started the Parkhurst deployment, were there jitters about whether this could actually work? I mean, you're committing a lot of money to network investment, your infrastructure investment. It's not a cheap game, as you mentioned. Were there any worries early on that this might not work?
No, not really. I think we were very excited about it rather than worried. Okay. We could see that it would work, that it could work. And it was a big bet. I mean, it was a substantial amount of cash that you need to outlay. But we fundamentally believe that the gap between DSL and what's required was so big at the time that there will be naturally demand. Mm. A lot of the analysts took a view to say that, oh no, the uptake will be 20% or 22% because they look at the UK or the States. But what they always forget is that in those geographies, there was cable as an interim solution that provided up to maybe 50 to 100 megs per second broadband connection, you know, the B-Sky B type of environment where you combine broadband with cable, etc., which had another segment of the market, which we didn't have. And in fact, the Eastern European countries didn't have this interim step. And if you look at their uptake, you could see, oh no, it's actually remarkably different. And we just formed that from personal experience and anecdotal evidence that clearly that must be the case for everybody else out there. And it proved to be right, I think. Mm.
So you ramped up pretty quickly after Parkhurst. Where did you go after Parkhurst and why?
Okay, so we went to Greenside, Parktown North, Saxonwold, Parkwood, Killarney, Riviera. We were sort of in the parks area. Why did we do it like that? Contiguous suburbs made sense because obviously we raise a lot of awareness in the suburb which we're in. Mm-hmm. And the suburbs next door drive through it and et cetera. And they realize that there's something happening and it's very easy to sell and to also make them aware that the disruption is not going to be as bad as you might imagine. And then from a synergies, from a practical operational perspective and backhaul perspective, it made sense to do that. But now, I think by August, September, I would say Joburg will be done.
Done.
We know it. Yeah, so the ring road, let's say the M1, the western bypass, north and west of that will be done.
So the leafy northern suburbs?
Yeah.
Okay. And is that Joburg? Do you not continue beyond that into the East Rand, the West Rand?
We will go to Ekurhuleni and further north and the Midrands, Centurions, etc. But I would say the 175,000 homes in Johannesburg will be serviced by us. Mm-hmm. And then in certain pockets like Parkview where DFA is or Houghton where Telkom is, which we won't overbuild on. But I think most of the households will have fiber by the end of the year, let's say.
What's happened in Bryanston? Because Telkom put a peg in the sand, if you like, and said, we're going to own Bryanston. And I know you were rolling out in Bryanston as well. Have you duplicated there?
Yeah.
You have?
We have. We're also committed to Bryanston.
Okay.
It's obviously one of the key areas within the Johannesburg area. We committed to some of the residents associations and consumers out there because we have this sort of express your interest stuff, and we made a commitment that if the consumers are over a certain threshold that we will come.
Okay.
And we got that expression and therefore we fulfill our commitment and come.
Okay.
But it's obviously a clear sign that there's enough interest out there. But it's very competitive in Bryanston especially.
Okay. I'm sure the people in Bryanston love it because the quality of service there has been poor for a long time, both in DSL and in mobile.
Yeah. No, I think so. And they've got choice now between providers. I think it's a good place to be in.
I want to talk a bit about the technology, the approach to delivering fiber into the home. You've historically focused on trenching. It's a more expensive option. You acquired a company called Fiberhoods, which does aerial fiber, which is obviously a cheaper way of deploying that infrastructure. Does that acquisition signal that you're going to use aerial fiber in some instances, or was that acquisition purely about gaining market share?
It was a mix of both, actually.
Okay.
Firstly, it was sort of a set of suburbs that really made sense. It complemented our footprint very well. The only overlap we had was in Melville, but it wasn't major. But we also felt that if you had to get to secondary towns and smaller towns, you need to bring the cost of deployment down. And as part of that, we also wanted to experiment with the deployment technology and some of the lessons that they've learned to see if that could be replicated elsewhere to bring the capital cost down in order to bring other areas perhaps into range, which we would not consider today because of the higher cost of trenched.
Interesting. So I had an interesting conversation with Jacques Dutoy, the CEO of Vox, this morning, and he was talking. They obviously own Frogfoot Networks, which is doing quite a bit of work in the Cape Town area. And he was saying that the cost of deploying fiber to the home shouldn't exceed more than about 8,000 to 10,000 rand. If you do that, it's not making business sense for you. Would you agree with those sort of numbers? I don't know if you can actually put numbers on the table in terms of what it's costing.
I would say that's sort of the range. If it costs you a lot more than that, then the amount that you need to recover to repay the capital from the subscribers becomes potentially just a tad too high. That you really need to shift the price range with the consumer to get the return. And what we've, I think, collectively done well in the marketplace is by building up, let's say, that kind of cost or broadly that level of cost. Fiber can compete with ADSL pricing now. Mm-hmm. I mean, in fact, it's cheaper to have fiber than to have ADSL in a lot of instances. So perhaps the consumer can absorb a higher price, but I don't think so, not maybe in the current economic climate. But yeah, I would agree with that sort of range.
Okay. And I know that you've gone into suburbs and said, we'll come and build infrastructure there if we can get 30% commitment from the community. Is that 30% the sort of figure you need to make this profitable? And what sort of attach rate are you actually seeing out in the marketplace? Is it meeting your expectations?
Yeah, I think the 30% for us was to make sure that it's been socialized enough in the environment rather than a financial, a purely financial, let's say, hurdle. Because it's disruptive to trench and so on, and we wanted to make sure that there's a sufficient amount of interest. Firstly, okay, where to go next? So put them in a race a little bit against each other, the suburbs, but also to make sure that enough people in the community understand what it's about. The take rates... is for my competitors it's terrible, but for the funders it's good. So we wouldn't be able to raise the money if the take rates aren't sufficiently there, because the banks are not naturally more conservative than we are. So I think the model works, and if you look at all the players, I mean, Jacques this morning, they raised money against it, and everybody else. So I think anecdotally the models show that it's worked, because there's now more history than there was about 2 years ago. And I think there's sort of a classic model that's emerged that makes sense for all the parties involved. Okay.
And in terms of consumer interest and consumer demand, are you finding that the average Joe out there knows enough about fiber and what it is, how it compares to ADSL or other access technologies? Or are you finding you're having to do a lot of education as well of the consumer space?
We can definitely see it's changing. I mean, 2 years ago, we had to do a lot of education. But over the last 2 years, we can see that the amount of, let's call it push sales, where you had to educate and the customer then agrees to buy the product, versus pull sales, as we call it, has changed dramatically. There's been a lot of talk around the braai, Netflix that's come, Showmax that's come. All of these things have sort of helped to drive the demand for the fiber. And I think there's a much greater sense of understanding. There's still a big chunk of consumers that's uneducated around the benefits around it. But that's because they live in a traditional sort of mindset on technology. It's sort of, okay, I just use it for email or my telephone number, and I just don't want to lose my telephone number. You know, it's there's still a section of the community out there. But I think over the next 2 years, it'll change very, very much.
Okay. You see a fairly rapid transition from fiber, from ADSL across to fiber in the coming years, and it's largely going to replicate that footprint. Do you think there's an opportunity to grow customers who have never been fixed line customers before in fiber?
Anecdotally, because we were never in the DSL space, but some of the service providers will tell you that in some of the suburbs in which we deploy fiber, there's at a net fixed line basis between ADSL and fiber to the home, there's more consumers after it's been deployed. Where the connectivity was very poor, like in Parkhurst, I think the average was like under 1 megabit per second. Clearly, a lot of the customers has moved over to LTE or, you know, dongle type of environment because of the fixed line was so poor. But now that when fiber to the home has come in, there's more fixed line subscribers ultimately. So I think there will be more fixed line subscribers in the longer, or than
more fiber,
ADSL.
Than ADSL.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask about pricing. We're obviously in a very tough economy. There's just been a downgrade. The economy is potentially facing a recession in the coming months. Consumers don't have much disposable income. How is that pressure? How are you seeing that pressure manifest itself in your business? And is there an opportunity, do you think, as you've become better at deploying fiber and become more efficient at it, do you think there's an opportunity to push down those prices? I know at the top end, people are paying 1,500 rand a month for uncapped broadband. At the base, I think the prices are sitting around 600-700 rand a month. Is there an opportunity to perhaps get into a more of a mass market and perhaps to help consumers who are feeling that pinch by offering fiber access at lower price points?
Yeah, I think perhaps. In total, what you'd need to do is sort of the price elasticity needs to work so that you can have still a total return of X over, you know, over the capital that you deploy. We've got a 4 meg product, which people thought we were crazy to do initially, but that was really to create an entry-level product, which is more in the range with the service provider's fees, about $430. Mm-hmm. And that's truly entry-level, and then as they experience fiber, they might go up the curve. I think the opportunity lies more in, for the consumer, a lot of the consumers are seeing fiber to the home as, let's say, a DSTV replacement, where you can, you know, you can get a 20 meg line for $600 plus 120, let's say, for Netflix. And unless you're completely, you know, fixated in the sport, and it depends on how well the Springboks play as well, which is not great at the moment, you know, that's an opportunity to save 700 and something bucks plus some versus what you would have had, you know, if you had to combine those costs with your DSL pricing. Or with your DSL costs out there. We also have some voice over IP guys, service providers now that provide like for $240, you get uncapped calls anyway. So you fix your costs for your home phone, your broadband, and for your entertainment perhaps. So I think that's where the opportunity lies. The infrastructure needs to be recovered somehow. And I don't think we've taken a very aggressive view on the duration of payback. It's not a short-term payback at all. It is infrastructure-related, utility-type returns that we're looking at here.
Okay. So you've made huge progress in Johannesburg. You've recently bought a small fiber-to-the-home player in Durban.
That's right.
I think they have some infrastructure around Mount Edgecombe, Klunga Rocks area.
Yeah.
And you also recently started in Cape Town.
That's right.
You've done some work in the City Bowl, I think.
Yeah, City Bowl's done.
Okay.
And now northern suburbs, first suburbs in Durbanville, has gone live in the last month or so. So we're busy deploying into the northern suburbs. So fiber to the Lapa behind the Boulevard curtain there. So we're busy there as well. But I think our key focus is clearly in the metropolitan areas at the moment. Yeah.
So a lot of investment still going into Johannesburg at this point.
Yeah.
You said you finish when? End of this year?
Yeah, let's say end of this year we'll be.
Do you then refocus on other metros after that?
Okay. Yeah.
So Cape Town,
I would think so, yeah. And they're going through a very similar growth curve in those metropolitan areas as we've been through here in Johannesburg. And I think maybe in 3-4 years' time it'll be, you know, there might be a point where we say, okay, I think we've got enough homes now.
Okay. So the fiber market in South Africa, I think one analyst estimated that there are about 24 fiber to the home operators in all in South Africa at the moment. Vumatel is the biggest one.
I would say Telkom is probably the biggest, and then us probably neck and neck there.
Okay. There's been a lot of talk about consolidation. I hear rumors every day that so-and-so is talking to so-and-so and so-and-so is talking to so-and-so. Mm-hmm. Do you continue to play a consolidation role? You've bought two companies so far. Are you continuing to actively look at opportunities to consolidate the market? Or at some point, do you get bought out by one of the big guys, like Telkom, for example?
Yeah. To the first question, I think we would always look at opportunities of expanding our network. If the network is of sufficient quality and deployed in a manner in which we think the customer experience will always be the same, because we provide up to a gigabit per second, so you know, we would need to make sure that could be the case and that it's easy to maintain. And we would continue to look at that if the prices make sense. We find that a lot of new new entrants in the market over the last year. Personally, I think they're making perhaps a mistake by thinking that they'll get a substantial premium to the cost of deploying it, because it is sort of a land grab type of mentality out there. But for some of these smaller networks to make sense, you need a certain amount of subscribers to cover a 24/7 network operating center, maintenance, overhead, etc. And if you don't build fast enough, your overheads eat you alive in the process. So I just don't know if all of them will make it in the end. Mm-hmm. So will we pay huge premiums? No. Will we pay fair value or, you know, at a discount? For sure. But I think time will tell. It's not as easy as people think to just dig a trench and lay some fiber out there. There's some lessons to be learned as well, and some do along the way. On the reverse side, yeah, I suppose we're being sort of inundated with approaches, which is natural, I think, at the moment. The mobile operators need to go into the fixed line space. I think there's no secret that they have to do that to provide converged services out there. Other infrastructure players expanding their footprint. So I suppose we're sort of the hot blonde in the bar with a short skirt at the moment, but at the moment we've got some plans so that we still need to fulfill before we succumb, and I'm not sure we will succumb. You know, I think we've got a lot of interesting stuff that we still want to try and do. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. I mean, given that the big telcos, you mentioned the mobile operators, are, I guess, coming from behind in the space, makes you a particularly attractive asset and could get you a very rich valuation at some point.
In theory, yes. I think the regulatory environment makes some of these transactions complicated. Like, for example, a telecom acquiring us, I can't see that ever happening. I can't see that would pass any regulatory muster anywhere. And similarly, you know, the dominance of some of the mobile operators and what effect that will have in the marketplace if they bought a big fixed line player. We saw the Neotel Vodacom transaction, although that is predominantly around spectrum, I think, was more where it fell over on. So I think some of these are tough. But will those big players buy up some of the smaller networks? I can't see them doing that, because just a regulatory effort to get small transactions through is not worth their while, I would guess. So they'll go for big acquisitions.
You guys must be real experts at project management, because you've got thousands and thousands of people out in the field digging up streets all over the place. Logistically, it must be a real challenge. How do you do it?
So, and this is where our historical experience comes from, I think, from the Birchman days and DFA and so on. We have our internal program management team, and this is where, you know, I might be sort of the face of Umatel, but Joe is the real killer out here. He knows how to run the program management office. We've got about 6,000 guys with picks and shovels in their hands out there every day. We do about 15 kilometers a day, and a lot of stuff can go wrong, as you can imagine.
And does go wrong.
So we've built the internal system over a number of years of how we run a program management office. That's very fiber specific, etc., which really assists us. But yeah, so we try and have control of the management of it in our own hands. And let's say the labor component and the material component is outsourced. But yeah, no, it's a project, it's a scale that is difficult to manage at times.
I'm sure. And I'm no doubt you have angry customers. I've seen them on forum sites.
Yeah, we do.
You dig up their driveways and they can't get into their house. And
Now we have some of that. And the mistake is probably on our side, not educating them enough. It's difficult to get to every particular customer. We work very hard at educating the homeowner that we are coming past. We leave them a note to say we're coming past, this is when we plan to do it. But you can imagine that it does go wrong. And that's been probably our biggest challenge over the last year. Just over a year ago, we were 50 staff members. Now we're 550. Scaling the number of customers, the call centers, just to get that scaling and maintaining the quality is really the key driver. So I think we're now at run rates of building out and supporting that won't really materially change as much. And it's to make sure that these processes just work and really are industrialized into the quality that we want. So that's, I suppose, our biggest challenge is just to become a big telco, I suppose.
And I suppose residents' associations and also consumer champions in particular neighborhoods are hugely helpful to you as well. Yeah. You always get in a neighborhood, you always get someone who's totally enthusiastic about getting fiber, and he'll help you in any way he can to get the infrastructure deployed. And I suppose those guys are really helpful to you in convincing perhaps consumers who aren't particularly interested in fiber and why this project must be done.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of champions out there, and they agitate the local residents and so on. What I see is happening though is that now that they see it's coming everywhere, there's not as much. It's just a question of time. It's not like in those early days where we want to be next. It's sort of okay. No, they'll come. And our plans are very obvious where we're going. So there's no secret really there. And it becomes more commonplace, I suppose, to have fiber. But yeah, no, they are fantastic, and we need as many of them as we possibly can, because they act as an extension of our business and help to educate the consumer out there as well.
And Ryan Hawthorne, of course, was the original protagonist.
He was the protagonist in Parkhurst, and he's probably sitting back having a coffee and thinking, look what I've done getting this whole market off its ground, but not dealing with all the trenching out there. But he's been very helpful, and Cheryl, the chairman. And yes, we have all of these sort of combinations out there. It's very interesting dealing with the residents' associations. They're so different in nature and makeup. So everyone is individual in there. Yeah.
Last question I wanted to ask you, Neil, was you're an open access network provider. You deploy infrastructure. You don't offer services. Does that change at some point in the future? You need to continue to grow revenues. The network is built. Here's the infrastructure. Do we now become an internet service provider, or do we offer other types of services on top of this network infrastructure we provided, or is that a no-go zone for you?
No, I think philosophically it's a no-go zone for us. The internet service provisioning services, we know them. I don't think we will ever go there. I think it's a very interesting time for those service providers, because in the past they differentiated from each other by how they throttled or managed the small bandwidth that was available. And today there is not that constraint. So how to differentiate among each other is really something they have to grapple with. And price can't be the only thing, because it's sort of a race to the bottom. So I think they're under pressure on how to not to be truly commoditized. So they need to add value to the feed. Our view is that we're building a telecoms infrastructure business at the moment, but it's really more a platform for smart cities of the future. And we would always be an infrastructure owner rather than a service provider. But the question is, what do we do with this infrastructure to take it beyond just the telecoms play? And that's where I think the interesting bits lay for the future for us, on how do we take this to another level.
Okay, I won't press you too much on that. Neil, before I let you go, I have to ask you where you sit on the capped versus uncapped debate. How many people are, how many subscribers on your infrastructure are going capped versus uncapped, and what do you think the future is of that debate?
I think roughly it's about 60% uncapped, 40% capped. There's no doubt in my mind that it's going to be uncapped. And there's no doubt in my mind also that the mobile operators will need to go uncapped.
On their mobile infrastructure?
On their mobile infrastructure.
Can they do that though?
I can't see why not.
The spectrum is limited. Fiber is kind of an infinite resource.
But as our footprint deploys, we can offload the data onto our fiber network.
Okay.
So I can see a world where voice is free, where data is, if you're on the N1 or, you know, driving around, uses the spectrum to offload some of that data. And then when you're in the metropolitan areas, etc., that through LTU or Wi-Fi or mobile data offloading through small cells onto the fiber networks will be the way to go. And perhaps the unlicensed spectrum or, you know, sort of the LTU combination between unlicensed and licensed will be a way to address that.
There are, of course, incredible developments happening in the mobile broadband space. That's with this new Samsung Galaxy S8 supports a theoretical download speed of up to a gigabit a second over the air. At some point, does the fixed line fiber become irrelevant because the mobile has become so good, or will there always be a place for it?
No, I think if you look at the evolution of the mobile, you know, when 2G came out and then 3G, every iteration there was exactly the same question. Is ADSL going to be replaced? And now with 5G, is fiber going to be replaced? But the proximity of the end of the tower, let's say the mini tower, needs to get so much closer to the consumer, and they need to be fed by fiber in order to realize those speeds. So I think LTE has also had the promise, which never really, I mean, it delivers, but it's not really delivered to the laboratory test environments. So I think it's going to go through the same evolution. 5G will probably get here, 2019, and then it depends on regulations and so on. So it'll be a while before that really becomes ubiquitous. In the meantime, you know, fiber will be in everywhere, and it will just make the deployment of those networks easier. So I think it won't replace it in the short term. Long term, I don't see that.
They'll coexist.
I think they'll coexist, yeah. I think the threat for the mobile operators is, as they try and get into the fixed line space, why would the fixed line providers not go into the mobile space? In the unlicensed spectrum range, nothing prevents us from putting up a very high-speed Wi-Fi network across the whole of Joburg now that I'm on every street in the city.
Are you saying you're going to do that at some
point? No, we never know. And then with the open access network on the spectrum side, which is in the white paper, whether that's realistic for that to be managed properly. But if that provides access, then as the mobile operators can come down into the fixed line space, the fixed line providers can obviously go into the mobile space. And there needs to be a point where a consumer knows they're paying $1,500 a month, uncapped mobile, uncapped fixed. I know what I'm paying. And I think that day will have to come at some stage, yeah.
Neil Skuman is CEO of Vumatel. Neil, that was a fascinating discussion. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Tech Central podcast.
No, thanks for having me. It was fun.